Coming up on this week's show, a programming language for making NES games.
A game where killing lemmings is the aim.
And we talk the games of a lifetime with Jazz Rignall.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our amazing sponsor, our friends at Bitmap Books. Now, you're going to hear a lot more about it on this week's show, but check out the new book, The Games of a Lifetime, bringing to life a look at video game history as seen through the eyes of this week's guest, the legendary games journalist and editor of iconic games magazines like Zap, CVG, Meme Machines, Julian Jazz Rignall. You can check that out and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our lovely friends at PCB Way. Now, everyone knows about PCB Way. They offer fully featured custom PCB prototyping, low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards, and if you're looking for services like 3D printing or injection molding, they've got you covered. And check out the shared project section on their website because they're big supporters of the retro community. Get an instant quote right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 467, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, James Walker.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And a very warm welcome to this week's podcast. Now, you might be thinking, hang on a minute, something a bit different about the start of the show this week. Our boy Joe Fox is having a bit of a rest.
Joe's gone walkies. He's gone to Barbados and he's relaxing on the beach.
No, I think he's just working late every night this week. So unfortunately, having a week off the podcast because he's got a lot else going on. But that does mean that we, I always like it when we welcome on guests to do the new section of the podcast with us. And this week it is someone who, anyone that's in our patrons community, I'm sure will know him. Anyone that reads magazines like Amiga Addict, where he's actually the games editor of Amiga Addict magazine. So we'll talk a bit more about that in a second. Let's welcome on our guest host this week, James Walker. How's it going, James?
Good. Thanks very much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Appreciate you doing that.
Yeah, I think we might be a bit Amiga heavy. Well, I was going to say we're going to be Amiga heavy without Joe, but looking at the news lineup, maybe not.
Yeah, I'm saying that. It's like, if we'd have planned this a bit better, we probably would have some Amiga stories in there. But I mean, whenever us guys get together, you know, you're often on the patrons' hangouts as well.
Yeah.
The topic of Amiga is never too far away, particularly when we see you at events and stuff too. So what's kind of your background then? I mean, were you like an Amiga fan back in the day? What's your history?
Long-term Amiga fan, but started on Commodore 64. That was my first PC, so, Micro. Yeah, absolutely loved that. Had that for a fair amount of time into the Amiga's life, actually, but lusting after looking at all the Amiga screenshots of the games I was playing on my C64 until I finally got a second-hand A500 from the paper, saw it advertised in the paper and got that. And then, went on to the 1200, then CD32, and still have those exact machines and still use them to this day, obviously, even more so now with the magazine. So yeah, I never really went away from Amiga, but with the start in the magazine back in 2020, when Jonah, Ian and I and Ravi, we all just started to come the idea of coming out with a print magazine when not necessarily optimal timing for print magazines.
What did you think about it when Jonah proposed the magazine originally? Because I was like, this is bonkers.
I was like, well, sure. But it didn't seem like, it seemed like a crazy idea. But, and obviously at the time we were joking about saying, oh, wouldn't it be amazing to have an Amiga magazine back in the, on the shelves of somewhere like WH Smith, which again seemed like just, well, ridiculous. But, obviously, it's WH Smith isn't quite what it is, but
yeah, we might outlast WH Smith.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Do you read the news lately?
So there'll be
I do love it though, because whenever I'm always in WH Smith when I go to like airports or train stations, because you know it's a captive audience, you can't really go anywhere else. But whenever I see Amiga Addict in like Heathrow or something, I'll always make sure I move it to the front of the stack.
We do appreciate when people do that, try and get the word out there. Yeah, it's mad.
We're working on issue 36 at the moment. That's just going to print, and we've just done issue 35 as well. So definitely check it out at AmigaAddict.com, because I also write for that. And we were just discussing how, you know, we're always the ones that are late with our copying, and we managed to get it in early this time.
Yes.
So that's good.
This issue, we were, we weren't on the naughty list. We were,
What's the NX issue about then? What's the cover?
So Silica is that they, obviously everyone, well, hopefully remembers their Silica adverts in the shops, and obviously a great piece of nostalgia for a lot of people. So we've got interviews and a big article on that. We try and sort of go gaming issue, main feature, and then non-gaming, either productivity or something like that, alternate issue to issue, so it's not just all about the games, although obviously I'm games editor.
What have you wrote about as well, James?
So I did Jump and then Tiny Pixel Adventure, so two new releases. We cover new releases every single month, and that's actually another thing. When Jonah said about starting a magazine, I was like, but there's not, we'll just have to review old games all the time. But of course, that's not the case at all. Obviously, there's just so many new releases coming out all the time. It's actually the opposite problem, where we have to kind of bump some games because we just don't have space to cover all the new releases. It's a good problem to have, though.
I was telling my brother that recently. I said, new Amiga games. He went, what? New Amiga? Yeah. Who the hell's making new Amiga games? I was like, read this magazine, it'll open your eyes.
Yeah. We don't struggle to fill the magazine at all. I thought we'd... Yeah, I was worried, obviously, when it was first announced when we first talked about it, we might have to do that. But no, we're normally pushing stuff to the next issue, it's the sort of opposite problem I thought we'd have.
Well, talking of magazines as well, this week's guest, we've got a legendary magazine writer that we've had on.
Yeah, now we're going to be chatting to Julian Jazz Rignall. Now, we have had Jazz on the show, God, must be going back 5, maybe 6 years ago now. Of course, worked for some iconic games magazines back in the day, Zap, CVG, Mean Machines as well. And we were talking actually before we started recording about, obviously, we used to watch him on Games Master back in the day as well. Yeah. The iconic mullet.
That was it. Yeah, he had quite a Pat Sharp style mullet going on.
Yeah, which he hasn't got anymore. But the reason we're going to be talking to him is because he's actually just released an amazing new book that we've all been reading, called The Games of a Lifetime. Now, that just launched this week. It is with our sponsor, Bitmap Books, little disclaimer. But, Sam and the team there said, look, do you want Jazz on? And we're like, God, yeah. I mean, whenever we chat to Jazz, he's always such an interesting guy. And we love the look of this book as well. I mean, there's so much in here. It's basically the history of video games seen through Jazz's eyes.
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually, because it talks about all the different systems of the times as well. And, it's a periodic as well, so it's going through each year. Really interesting to see what was big at the time. And also, there's a lot of memories there of stuff that, wasn't in the magazines. A lot of personal experience as well.
It is a really personal look at video games history. So we're going to be learning more about that. And obviously a very nostalgic chat with our guest this week, Julian Jazz Rignall. He's on the show in around half an hour from now. But of course, it is business as usual this week. First half of the podcast is when we go through the headlines, the big stories from the world of retro gaming and technology from over the last week. And this one, I think, is really cool. Now, you mentioned before then, James, about the amount of new games that are coming out on the Amiga recently. I think there are several other platforms as well that seem to be getting a lot of love recently, including the old school NES. And this story is about a programming language that is specifically made for building NES games.
Okay, so this is NESFAB. And NESFAB is a new programming language for specifically programming on the NES. It looks really interesting. We've seen how these programming languages help people kind of, create stuff and get a lot quicker with it as well. I guess it's tough programming in some of the old, assembler and native kind of languages. It's a skill that's maybe been lost. There's some people that do like high level coding and stuff, but this is quite an easier way of doing it, with easy to kind of understand functions. I remember Game Boy Studio. That was one that we covered recently, GB Studio. And this looks like it has quite a few good functions. It's got a map fab as well, which is a way of kind of integrating maps and levels into it and creating a level editor. It's interesting because it's designed for one specific system. So it seems like this is, you know, hardcore for the kind of NAS coder. I don't know how much you can translate or change a project that's been done in this language to work on another system.
I think it's there. It sounds like it's trying to basically make it easier for NAS-specific development. It's still, obviously, you've got to be a decent coder to use it, but it just takes away some of the difficulties that usually associated with it. Makes life a bit easier, but probably at the expense that it probably would be harder to port it to another system if you did write it in that language.
Did you ever try programming yourself when you were a kid?
Yeah, tried. I realized I wanted to program, but I didn't want to learn to program, unfortunately, which is the first step.
Kids are so lucky with AI and stuff today.
Yeah, exactly.
Make me a game, ChatGPT. Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if it's super inefficient, because it doesn't matter, you've got loads of resources, so you can just mash in what ChatGPT says, and it doesn't matter if it's the best thing, it will just probably work eventually.
But before ChatGPT quite gets to the stage where it can do perfect games, I think this is a nice little stopgap, at least. NES Fab, I think, basically the code apparently looks a bit like C, but it's actually a language just made for the NES, as we mentioned.
It also looks interesting, some of the features in there as well. So, you know, before you'd use a lot of scripts to convert things, and it can actually do it within this language. So, you know, dropping assets in there, like images, it will convert to work well. And, you know, that's really speeding up things when you're doing it. I can imagine, you know, developing for something like that with tons of scripts set up. You've got loads of different programs. You've got to kind of adjust everything and go through. I can imagine how long that takes. So this may definitely speed up stuff.
Yeah, and I think just, you know, we often talk about new NES releases. I mean, it is a system that does already get quite a lot of love on the homebrew scene. So I think the fact that there are stuff like this, you know, is going to make it probably even more NES games for us to cover in coming months. I mean, you know, talking about the Amiga, James, I mean, what you know, obviously you see new games coming out on there. We've talked about stuff like, you know, Scorpion Engine and things like that. I mean, do you find most current Amiga games are using newer tools, or are they generally going back to like Amos and Blitz Basic?
I think there's still a lot of people who just want to kind of get the hardware manual and all the reference manuals and code straight, assembly language, or just going straight to doing the hardcore version of coding. But definitely Scorpion Engine particularly there's a lot of games coming out for that now. In the previous magazines reviewed a few Tiny Pixel Adventure, the issue that's out or about to be out, and then Dr. Dangerous by the same creators. Every week or so there's another new Scorpion Engine one as well, so it has massively ramped up the new game. So maybe this same will happen with NES.
Interestingly, there's a link between the NES and the Dreamcast as well. So Low Tech Games, who we previously had on the podcast, released a NES to Dreamcast converter, which basically would convert it to using NES to DC, but it would create like a standalone game. So maybe, you know, these releases would have a good like little path to the Dreamcast, and it just wouldn't be limited to that one system.
Yeah, I think actually with Scorpion Engine again, there's a Mega Drive.
Yeah,
because with the Star Wars game, the Holiday Special that just came out, that was a Mega Drive.
Yeah,
based on a SNES game, but then it was a Mega Drive game ported over to Amiga on Scorpion Engine. So that you're right; these sort of engines can as well hopefully help get games onto multiple platforms, not just the one.
Yeah. So, but if you do love the NES at the moment, NES Fab, which is available now to download, I'll put a link to that in this week's show notes. Now, this next game that we're going to talk about looks so much fun. And again, I mean, this is a game I'm thinking would be great if it was ported to other platforms. Not being an MSX owner myself, although I'm sure there are very decent emulators available for anything and everything these days. But this is basically a version of Lemmings for sadists. If, like me, you got joy back in the day of getting your screen full of Lemmings and then maybe pausing the game and then just double clicking that little new icon and watching them pop all the way along the screen in different. I can't be the only one that did that.
Never got old. Always a good way to relieve frustration.
Well, this is at Doomlings on the MSX, and the flip on the Lemmings concept here is that instead of, I mean, I'm sure most of our audience have played the original Lemmings game that, again, started on the Amiga, but came out on absolutely everything back in the day and continued to for many years. The idea of that is these little rodents fall out of a kind of a trapdoor in the sky, and then you have to safely plan their path to get to the exit, taking them across, you know, all these multiple things that are trying to kill them in the level. But this one actually flips out of its head, and the aim of this is for you to actually kill the lemmings.
Yeah, I think this is an awesome kind of idea, because you've got to stop them from being rescued, and it totally flips the whole game, like you said. I think this would have been a great mode in Lemmings. Yeah. You know, murder mode, and everything just went dark, and the music was like, you know, very, very evil kind of stuff.
On the surface, it sounds like way too easy, but of course they're going to be designing the levels specifically for to make it hard for you to kill them. But
yeah,
I certainly, this was the way I accidentally played most versions.
Yeah,
anyway,
you should be a genius at this end, James, when you play it. Yeah,
I also think this is really interesting where this has come from as well. So it's MSX Dev, which is a gaming competition for the MSX, and you know, this is an annual one, and it's been running since 2003. And 31 games were submitted for this, which is pretty amazing. Wow. And like some of the donations as well, yeah, €400,000 by anonymous people. And yeah, some of the donations are absolutely bonkers, 100,000 as well.
That's the thing, because we forget just kind of how big platforms like the MSX were outside the UK. You know, because it was like, obviously it wasn't a success in this country, but in certain parts of the world, it was like, you know, one of the most mainstream platforms.
Yeah. And this is, you know, amazingly generating kind of these games and innovations and different ideas that we're now covering in the news. So it's great to kind of see these game dev competitions, because some really good stuff comes out of it.
Now, I'm not sure how long this game is. There is a little gameplay video that you can watch. There's only one video on YouTube at the moment on Saberman Retro News. He doesn't manage to get past the second level of the game, though. So, and it doesn't actually say on the website how many levels are in here. Well,
you can play it online on filehunter.com.
Right,
well.
Okay.
So, yeah.
That's yeah, good I haven't to tried it yet, but be good to give it a go.
Well, some of the lemmings seem to have skills, like, you know, some of them are climbers by default. Because I was wondering that if later on in the game, whether they, you know, become bridge builders and that kind of thing, like the tools the lemmings could actually have in the original game. So that'd be interesting to see.
But like kill each other with a pickaxe.
Yeah, I mean, like, just depend. Yeah, kind of whether all the levels are just designed that they can just walk it is basically what I'm saying, or whether they get more complex as the game goes on.
Like the blocker just punches you.
Yeah, I mean, I've not seen any blockers in here yet. So
deathmatch.
Yeah, so I think, you know, again, it is a homebrew game though, so maybe I'm asking a bit too much, but it does seem loads of fun. So if you want to get hold of that, I'll link that in the show notes as well to fire up on your MSX or emulator. Now, this next story is quite a sad one, actually. Again, this is another homebrew game that we're going to talk about here. But actually, this was a port of a massive game to the Commodore 64. And I believe you pronounce this Balatro?
Balatro? I call it Balatro, but I could be wrong.
Well, this is a massive game that's particularly popular on mobile, but it's also on Windows, Switch, PlayStation, Xbox, Mac, and received last year three awards at the Game Awards. It got Indie Game of the Year. It won Best Debut Indie Game and Best Mobile Game. So, very popular title. It's kind of a roguelike deck-building game. And this got a port to the Commodore 64 that looked very promising. But it turns out now, thanks to the old takedown that the publisher Playstack have done, this has now vanished.
It's a real shame, because it was coming along absolutely brilliantly. It seemed it was almost, well, it's pretty feature complete, I think. Obviously, yeah, for people who don't know, it's heavily based around poker. So it's a roguelike deck building game, but heavily poker based. So you're trying to make up sort of poker hands. And you get these sort of jokers who have different effects on the game. And that was all in there, all in the game. So fingers crossed the dev can come to some agreement. Maybe they could... I can imagine sort of developers now are kind of cottoning on to the whole retro scene, aren't they? So I'm hoping they'll put some money behind him even and sort of get this possibly published properly and maybe add it as a sort of special mode in some of the other editions, because it's pretty much available on every platform. So yeah, hopefully there'll be some good news come out of this road sort of for the moment.
He seems quite like the developer, Coco, seems quite pleasant with, well, not pleased, but kind of says, you know, they reached out to him in a very polite and professional manner.
Yeah.
He's like fully respecting their wishes. And that makes me think there might be some kind of, you know, deal maybe done on something. Yeah, you know, it would be good. Like, we saw Farm Simulator had a C64 version. You know, it is possible to kind of get these modern releases having old versions.
Yeah, and I say it's still the fun of, because it is a, I mean, it's a complicated game in some ways, but the fun of it is quite a simple idea of just scoring big poker hands, things like that. So it translates really well to the C64, actually. I have played this version, and it you actually kind of get the same feeling as you do on mobile, albeit visually it's obviously had some compromises, but it's actually pretty remarkable how close and all the mechanics he's managed to keep in there. It's pretty impressive.
These often seem to be the big games that blow up on mobile, aren't they? Like, I remember when Flappy Bird was like huge and that got ported to everything, and that ran really well on the Commodore 64, that really simple game mechanic.
Yeah.
It's obviously simplicity sometimes, isn't it, that just does the trick, you know?
And those sort of score attack type games, and I say just trying to beat the bosses and all the different curveballs it throws you with the different mechanics. With the visual compromises, I do wonder if someone played it who hadn't played the main game on mobile or on any of the other platforms, I do wonder if they'd know what was going on particularly. But if you're familiar with the game anyway, it plays great on the Commodore 64, and might need a manual though to go with it for people who haven't.
Did you play it on original hardware?
No, I didn't. The 64 one I didn't, unfortunately.
Right.
Because, I must admit I played it on on emulator. I have got my original 64 still, but it's a bit worse for wear since I stored it in the loft at my parents' house.
Oh, yeah, I've got an Acorn Electron that's a bit like that. One day I'll get around to sorting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've bought the bits I need to repair it, and then not done that because
is that the one that you drove over with your car, Dan?
Yes, well, not on purpose. I was moving house and it fell out of a bag, and I reversed my car over it. So to add insult to injury, it survived though. I mean, it still didn't break or anything.
Solid.
So
wow,
yeah, don't make them like that anymore. But yeah, I mean, in terms of this game getting taken down, I mean, I'm looking through the comments on the itch page. A lot of people hating on PlayStack, the publisher, for taking it down. But I think it was a difficult one.
People are at pains to say that it wasn't the dev of Bellatro that took it down or requested it be taken down, it was the publisher. So hopefully the dev is more amenable and will have a word and hopefully get things sorted out. Who knows? But
yeah, it's always a tricky one, that kind of line between, you know, pleasing the fans and the kind of business side of things, isn't it? So I do understand both sides of it.
Yeah, it does seem like they probably wouldn't have lost any sales to this though. It
sounds like they're doing all right anyway, you know?
Well, massively. Yeah, I mean, I bought it on Android when it came out back in September, so I was fairly late to it, but I was surprised. It is a lot of fun. It's definitely worth picking up, and then hopefully then playing the C64 version when it comes out of this current state.
And apparently it grossed $1 million in its first week, and then $4.4 million in 2 months.
So,
like you said, you know, if they do lose one or two sales due to someone rather than play on the Commodore 64, not going to break the bank. Although, the developer of the C64 version said he has reached out to them and basically offered this version of the game for free. So he's open to kind of any solution to publish the game. Still waiting on them to get back to him. But the time we're recording, this was only like 10 hours ago that he posted that. So if there are any updates, of course, we will let you know. Fingers crossed that gets sorted out. Now, this next game looks right up your street, Ravi. But James, are you a fan of RTS games? Did you play many of them?
I am, yeah. I played a lot of them, but I'm more a fan of them than they are of me. I'm quite bad at them. So I enjoy them up to the point where I get so terrible I can't complete them anymore. But I lived in a shared house when I went out to work, and we'd all be have our PCs networked up and be playing things like StarCraft and Red Alert 2. Oh,
I remember that, like LAN cables up the stairs.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It literally was that. We had it was old enough, it had BNC cables because we had a BNC LAN at the first. And BNC cables coming down the stairs of the house all over the place. Yeah, it
was playing till the sun comes up.
Exactly, so good. Yes.
Yeah, what day of the week is it now?
Exactly.
I must say, it's a genre I haven't ever massively got into. Maybe because of that, because I'm a bit nervous that it might suck me in a bit too much.
Yeah, I've not touched the new Civilization game because to me it looks like just,
you've got a job.
My life would disappear, quit my job, just give up, yeah.
Well, this game seems to, like I said, it's not a genre that I'm massively into, but this seems to get a lot of love. This is a game called Combined Arms. Now, apparently this is a free kind of Command & Conquer game.
Yeah, so this is a mod that basically runs on OpenRA, which is like the open implementation of Red Alert. So it's allowed Red Alert and Command & Conquer, which are of a period of time with Command & Conquer, which I absolutely love. Like a lot of people, there was a bit of a change when Tiberian Sun came out, which was like the later ones, and it modernized a bit and it got a bit spacey. This was kind of like the old school Command & Conquer. And interestingly, James, there's been a port of it for the Amiga as well.
Oh, yes.
OpenRA. So you have the ability to play it.
If you're thinking of things to write about next month.
I'll definitely check that out. Obviously, yeah, with like the June 2 game kind of starting, arguably popularizing, I guess, would be the RTS
Dune
genre.
Dune 2000 also plays on this engine as well, which is quite a hard one to kind of play. But the problem is you need to get the original file, so you need to play the original kind of title. Well, without having those original discs, Combined Arms is basically a brand new standalone game. So you can download it for free straight away. You can run it on your Mac or any other system. It might even work on that Amiga version. Who knows? Maybe with a bit of changing, but what it is it's got all of the different groups in there from Red Alert, but it's got lots of special features in as well. It's like 20 new maps as well with co-op on there, Nod Third Age Alliance as well. There was a whole thing about Alliance and Communists and GDI and the Hand of Nod and the Skrin and stuff. All of them are on this, all the mad big units as well, and the later stuff that they had. So it does look really fantastic, and it's just received a massive update as well. And this update's kind of added extra things in there, like, you know, hotkeys were allowed. There's stuff like Harvester Under Attack, which to me, when I was playing this game, that was so utterly important because you'd be focused on other stuff and suddenly your whole monetary flow goes.
That's a disaster. Hopefully they've got Tim Curry in there as well somehow.
I don't know if they've got the FMVs. But this just looks awesome. Like, this could totally take my whole time up. And it was first released in November 2024. But they seem to be updating it. Yeah, and there's a lot of these Command & Conquer mods out, but it's good to see them coming out for this engine that's like available on a lot of stuff. You know, the news we're actually covering is from a Linux website. So, you know, obviously a lot of people are playing this on Linux as well.
It's weird because I keep getting recommended videos on YouTube over the last couple of weeks, actually gaming on Linux videos, probably because of something I searched for at some point, but it does seem to be, going back to that kind of more traditional mindset, it was always, you know, if you want a game on a computer, it's got to be Windows. But it does seem like, you know, the gaming scene on Linux in particular, you know, I guess with a lot of open source ports like this as well that are ported to it, does seem like a lot more of a viable gaming
platform. It's great as well. You've got Mac here as well. You can run it on the Silicon ones, and just fantastic.
Obviously Steam doing a lot for Linux as well. This looks awesome. I mean, I'm looking through the changelog on GitHub. It's massive. So it looks like the really putting a lot of work into this at the moment.
You know, a lot of people, so they did the remaster of Command & Conquer, Command & Conquer Red Alert, and like I had that, and a lot of people loved it. It was well done, new music, stuff like that. But the AI and stuff didn't feel quite right. And there are a few things, you know, that the classic ones feel a lot better with. So it's interesting to see them kind of going back to the classics and improving that area as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So you want to get hold of that now. It is a free download, and I'll put the link to that in this week's show notes. Now, what about a little a light-hearted one, but something that I think is very cool to kind of round off the news this week. And this is a new survey that's been done by a group called Consumer Reports, who are a non-profit organization in America who basically do, you know, a lot of consumer trends and market research. And they've done a new survey with a couple of very surprising stats that have been pulled out of this, including the big one for us, that apparently 14% of North Americans still play gaming systems released before the year 2000. Is that surprising?
We're probably the wrong crowd to ask for that. Yeah,
just that we're not alone, guys. It's not just us. Well, so that, I mean, you look at that. I mean, I'm not the best at maths, but I've I think there's 340 million people in North America. So it works out about 47 million people, which, you know, I think what's our population here, like 70 million?
Yeah.
You know, I wonder what the kind of percentage is in Europe as well. Ooh, and then also what the percentage is in Japan and those countries. You know, I think it's interesting because when I went over to America, there was a huge culture still of pinball. But also, you know, there's like one-up arcades. They weren't sold just in game, like, or a specific store, you know, for gaming. They were just in Walmart, like in the middle of it, and it was a thing that people would go by and actually purchase.
It does shows how mainstream, I guess, it's become, hasn't it? The fact they're selling them not just in niche shops but in openly, and people are buying them. It also explains why the prices have gone nuts if so many people are buying them.
I think I'm going to New York in April, so if anyone's got any suggestions of good places to go in New York for retro stuff, please do ping us a comment.
I think there were a few stores. Yeah, I went to one. But you have to travel far, I think, to find it. But it was well good. It was full of dusty stuff and, like, you know, amazing retro titles.
You know the only reason I'm going to New York.
What?
Ghostbusters Firehouse. Come on. Which you took a picture in front of that years ago and I was so jealous. I'd be like, right, I'm going.
I thought you were going to say pizza or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that goes without saying as well, obviously. But yeah, I think this is really interesting. And also, I mean, there have been some more kind of surprising stats that have been pulled out of this survey. Apparently 15% of Americans listen to music on cassette tape in the last year.
I've heard it's coming back. I wonder if they're what the age group is, if it's young people sort of discovering their old, more tactile technology, or if it's old people trying to play Wet 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 or something.
No one's trying to play Wet Wet Wet. They're sick of it after that giant number one. I think it's interesting because America's so big, rolling out technology takes longer, but still cassette, you know. But it's a huge country and interesting to see. I was amazed to find that, you know, people in Brazil were still using like composite signals and play Mega Drives and stuff. So yeah, it's weird. You never know about a culture around the world. And they're also saying Laserdisc movies.
Yeah, 3% of the population.
3% is huge for Laserdisc. Wow. Like, millions of people.
15% have watched a movie on VHS in the last 12 months. Now, I've talked about it in the podcast before, that weirdly, I have started to buy VHS tapes again recently after my uncle basically gave me his old video recorder to do a digital backup of his wedding tape from the late 80s. And he said afterwards, just, I don't want the video recorder back, throw it in the bin. I was like, oh, I'll keep it. And annoyingly, I actually threw out all my VHS tapes out of my parents' attic when they moved about 5-6 years ago. Started to buy all the same ones back off eBay. Yeah. And any I spot now, I was watching Red Dwarf on VHS over the weekend.
Oh, that's it.
Yes.
Yeah. So you guys, when did you last watch a VHS tape, James?
I did actually buy RoboCop on VHS fairly recently. Because I was similar, I threw out, I lugged them house to house, all my VHS, and then finally threw them away just before I could maybe start to appreciate them. But yeah, I do need to, I've got some old camcorder tapes myself I need to get digitized, so I need to drag out the VHS.
VHS store in Alphington where you can actually rent them.
Yes, I did see a news article about that, about there's a store that still rents
It's a new one, I think. Yeah, it just popped up a couple of years ago. It's not far from here.
Crazy, yeah. And yeah. I think the maddest fact out of all of this is 11% of American households still use a fax machine. I didn't know that fax services still worked. And, like, I hardly ever used fax machines. I do remember once, like, going to my dad's friend's office, just drawing really rude things and then faxing, like, to other fax
to his contact list.
Yeah, just dirty stuff, yeah.
Okay, well, I mean, fax machines, oh God, I mean, I worked in an office until a couple of years ago, and I think we did have one when I left back in about 2022. There was one in the corner that every now and then, maybe like once a month, that it'd make a noise and something would come through from, like, some kind of PR agency or something who... I hadn't caught up with the times, but it was always a bit of a, it's a fax machine. So yeah, the fact that, I mean, I wouldn't have even thought 11% of households would have used them even back in the 90s.
Yeah,
I
didn't know that, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We should do like a retro hour fax service.
Like a newsletter. That we send out on fax.
Do Amiga Addict.
We could do the fax edition. You tell us your number and we'll fax it over.
I think I did get I got a fax modem. Like in the late 90s, early 2000s. And I do remember just kind of trying it out. I think I might have faxed my mum at her office one day just to see if it worked. But yeah, never anything that really, like you said, so much use outside of business, at least over here. So really interesting report then. Like you said, Ravi, I think it would be interesting if there was a similar kind of survey done over here or you know, rest of Europe as well. So the Americans still loving a bit of retro. So it would be nice if we could pick up a few more of them 47 million listeners as well, wouldn't it? So, you know, spread the word. So if you want to check that out, and of course, all the rest of the stories, you don't have to Google around. I save you the job every week. I put them in the show notes on the podcast app, or you can head through to the website, theretrohour.com. All right, before we chat to this week's special guest, the legend that is Jazz Rignall, all about his incredible new book and lots of nostalgia about his games of his lifetime. He's coming up on the podcast in just a minute. Now, before that, let's take a quick moment to give a massive thank you to this week's sponsor, and they are a huge supporter of our little podcast. This is our friends at Shopify, the ones with this wonderful sound. Of course, that is the sound of making a sale on Shopify. And it's so easy to do, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's great because I've seen a lot of people selling at these markets and, video game events and different conventions. And getting all your kind of stuff in there, all your inventory and your whole store set up, you can really quickly just choose an item, sell it. You can also do it from a point of sales unit. Another thing is also the marketing, which I'm not amazingly good at, but, you know, you can use new systems like TikTok and, Pinterest as well. You can put all your stuff out there from Shopify, and that's really good because it allows you to just publish and fire it out over all of those channels.
It saves so much work. And if you sell anything, like you said, in person with the point of sale systems or online as well, Shopify is the all-in-one commerce platform designed to start, run, and grow your business. So maybe you've got a bit of a side hustle going on right now. Maybe 2025 is going to be the year that you become your own boss. A lot of people doing that right now. Shopify has got everything you need, and it's revolutionizing millions of businesses all around the world. So they cover all your sales channels as well. And like you said, that marketing built in across all the social media marketplaces, full of industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth every step of the way. The best thing about it as well is we've set up a Shopify store. You actually made ours in your lunch break, Ravi. It's like you don't need any coding or design skills, nothing like that.
Super easy, drag and drop, you can do that. But also if you really want to get into like advanced complex checkouts, you can also do that and like dig into the code.
And they've even got a really extensive, award-winning, in fact, business course library and online help as well. So they're ready to support your success every step of the way. So it's time to get serious about selling. Why don't you give Shopify a try today? Now, we've got you, like Ravi mentioned, an incredible offer. You can try Shopify out for just £1 a month on a trial period. You make one sale. That's covered, isn't it? Probably a lot more,
I'd hope.
Crazy. Yeah, so a no-brainer. So if you sell anything at all in person or online, give it a try by heading to our link. They'll know that we sent you, helps out the podcast, shopify.co.uk/retrohour, all lowercase, shopify.co.uk/retrohour, and get ready to take your business to the next level today and hear a lot more of this. All right, well, thank you so much for checking out the news this week. Thank you, James, for coming on and being our guest host.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. It's a lot of fun.
It's been awesome having you on. Yeah, you've done really well, mate.
Yeah.
Thanks. So, yeah, you probably have to cut out a fair chunk of waffle, but I won't be offended.
AmigaAddict.com for the magazine, if you want to read James Games features and reviews. New issue coming out soon, as we said. So
Addict.media as well.
Yeah,
absolutely. Check that out.
Got the Pixel Addict, Sister Mag, and then the specials like Atari Addict and and the various and Amstrad.
Another good paper magazine. So keep up the good work, guys, with that. And hopefully we'll see you on the patrons hangout at the end of the month as well.
Yes.
Yeah. So next we're going to be joined by this week's special guest, Jazz Rignall, talking about the games of a lifetime. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle. With ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest. And it's someone who we always have so much fun talking to. A celebrated game journalist, editor of iconic gaming mags back in the day. Zap, he worked for CVG, Mean Machines, of course, as well. Now, we did have Jazz on episode 233 back in 2020. Which is insane, it was that long ago. But today we thought we'd get him back on because he's just released a brand new book via Bitmap Books this week called The Games of a Lifetime. Now this is, it's a video game time machine that takes you on an incredible journey from the dawn of the industry through the decades to the present day, all viewed through Jazz's eyes. And it weighs in at a massive 420 pages. So to talk about that, and of course, lots of nostalgia as well, we thought we'd welcome on the legend that is Jazz Rignall. How's it going, Jazz?
Very well, thank you, and I really appreciate you guys having me on, especially for the second time, like a bad penny turning up again, basically.
No, we always love talking to you, and this book, I mentioned to you before we started recording, I was going through it at the weekend, and I love the approach of it as well, because, you know, there are a lot of other books out there kind of chronicling the history of video games, and this is not a book about your favourite games or even really a historical record, is it? It's a very personal journey. So what was the idea behind the book when you first came up with it?
I'd fancied writing a book for quite a while, and so what happened after I left IGN, just like turn of the century stuff, I kind of started writing little anecdotes about things to keep kind of my writing sharp, because at that point I was working outside of the industry. I was working at an ad agency, and then I worked for like Bank of America doing that online banking and launching that and stuff. So I was kind of doing odd things. So I kind of wanted to kind of keep my skills sharp. So I started writing these anecdotes. That sort of turned into, oh, actually, maybe I could sort of like turn this into a series of essays about like good games. And then I got the job at GamePro, sort of running the mag, and I was like writing and running around like a maniac all day, every day. And I was just like, oh, I can't be writing. So I kind of eased off, because I was, at that point, I was thinking, man, maybe I could get something out for my 30th anniversary work in the industry. That would be really cool. That sort of deadline approached and then went. And I was like, no way am I going to do my book. So it kind of like I left it for a few years, and then when the pandemic happened, all of a sudden, you know, we all had some time on our hands. I was like, oh, I could start writing that thing. And then it sort of like, at that point, I had quite a lot of stuff sort of put together, and I was just looking at it, and I was like, individual essays, it feels a bit discombobulated. So then I kind of just looked at it and realized that, oh, actually, a lot of these things are from like different periods of my life, and just began to string it together on the timeline, which kind of made sense, because like you say, it's what I want to do is video game time travel. And it's, you know, the important thing was I didn't really want it to be like this sort of like super rose tinted nostalgia fest, which, you know, there's a lot of that stuff out there and, you know, it's great and all the rest of it. But that's A, that's kind of not really what I do. What I wanted to do was like take you back and like try and explain, you know, why this particular game that, you know, sort of 40 years later, it looks like a couple of Lego bricks being thrown about the floor, is actually revered and loved by people because at the time, you know, it was this and it was the first time that had happened. And yes, it might look crap, but actually it was really good because we didn't have anything else. So it's kind of like giving that context. So, you know, the idea being that if you lived through that era, you can look at it and kind of laugh at it and also kind of recognize, you know, what it was like seeing, you know, an isometric 3D game like Antitech for the first time and just like, holy crap, it's a 3D world that has never existed before in any, in, you know, anywhere. And now I'm in it and I can move my dude around. And, you know, just that sort of like, just what an incredible experience that was. And really trying to follow that all the way through history.
It's interesting because, you know, you talk about kind of limitations there and stuff. The book starts with you in a remote part of Wales where you were growing up, you know, limited TV access as well. And you had comics, books and radio. How did you kind of get your imagination working and how did, you know, these other formats inspire you?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way you answer it with the question that radio is inherently an imagination-based format because I would be listening to radio plays or like sports commentary, whatever it was, a Grumbleweeds comedy. And it's an oral medium. So there's no visual medium. So you know, I would be listening to like Lord of the Rings, like the audio adaptation of Lord of the Rings, you know, being read by actors. And I would be imagining what was happening in my head. And reading a book is exactly the same thing, right? I mean, if you want to inspire your imagination, read a freaking book because that's what books do. So in that sense, you know, the sort of the fact that I didn't have TV made my imagination, I think it really fueled my imagination because I was, especially in the early days, dealing with medium that required you to have an imagination. And even then segueing into games themselves, you know, those early games required a really good imagination to kind of fill in the gaps. You know, it's like, all right, there's my little dude and he's running along the bottom of the screen and he looks like, you know, he's made out of like 7 pixels.
Mm.
But we, you know, we'd fill it in. And as far as we're concerned, that's Rambo and he's got a bazooka and he's shooting down a giant helicopter, which might be wobbling about the screen and flickering. But, you know, you would fill in the gaps. And so, you know, these days video games are very literal and, you know, often sort of, you know, photographic and you don't really need to use your imagination. The imagination's more about the characters and what's going on in the world. But back then it was, you know, you had to use the imagination for absolutely everything, you know, what you were looking at, the premise, everything. So I think, you know, in those early days, having imagination was really important. And I think, you know, a lot of those early gamers were very imaginative by nature because you had to be to kind of appreciate them. If you took them at face value, which some people did, you know, you're like, what is this little blob and shooting at another blob? You know, there'd be another kid there saying, this is the coolest thing because he, in his head, you know, he's the hero and he's fighting, you know, cool space people.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, speaking of a game where you had to use a lot of imagination, in the book, you describe your first encounter with Pong in Woolworths as a life-changing moment. I mean, can you kind of take us back to that day? And what was it about Pong that really captured your imagination?
Yeah, it's funny, actually, because I, you know, when I was sort of writing that first chapter, which probably, and, you know, I don't know, I've probably written about two-thirds of the book already in sort of like bits. And then I was like, all right, I need somewhere to start. So I was like thinking back and I was like, I can't believe that I got to be, what, I was 11 years old and somehow hadn't seen a Pong machine before. And I was like really trying to figure it out. And I think, you know, maybe I might have seen a Pong machine somewhere in an arcade, you know, in an arcade somewhere on my travels or something, but I just don't remember seeing it. But I definitely remember that experience of walking into Woolies, going up to the like the little electronics counter that they had, which, you know, usually had a couple of calculators on it, which is what I was going to fiddle about with while my mum did her shopping. They, you know, you'd sit there because calculators in, what, 1976 were like really cool. Yeah. You know, it's like, yeah, OK, you could just do sums on them. But, you know, that was something that you'd never been able to do before. And, you know, and then you sort of figure out, you know, the boobies thing. Oh, look, I can make boobies, you know, and that kind of stuff. And so I'd gone over to check those out, and there was this Pong machine with a couple of kids playing it. And it, you know, sort of like looked at the screen, and, you know, it just, there was probably about a second of like, what the hell's that? And then like a second later, it was like, oh, I got what, you know, it's like, oh, there's two bats and there's a ball, and I guess they're controlling it. You didn't know how. Closer look, oh, they're holding these little sticks and moving them. So it's like, all right, I get that. And so instantly this sort of like this concept of people playing tennis on a TV screen in front of me, and I've never seen it before, you know, just witnessing that was just like, this is really cool. You know, what else does it do? So, you know, I sat there and watching that, and, you know, the kids eventually got yanked off by their parents. So I immediately grabbed up the controller, started fiddling with the buttons on it, you know, sort of found the solo squash mode, and was just sitting there like bing, bing, bing against the wall with my bat. And I was just like, wow, this is just absolutely brilliant. You know, I mean, I imagine if I'd sat there for, you know, 20 minutes playing it, I'd be like, you know, does it do anything else? And plus, it was designed for two players anyway. But just that concept of, like, moving the thing on screen that I'm controlling, and it's some sort of game, that to me was just like, yeah, without doubt the coolest thing I'd seen in my life.
Well, you also were really into dystopian fiction as well. So Arthur C. Clarke and Orwell. You know, how did that influence the type of games you were drawn to, like, later on, and, you know, even how you wrote about them?
Yeah, you know, that dystopian science fiction was just a huge thing for me, throughout my, even preteen. I was, you know, reading, you know, this sort of, you know, end of the world stuff, or the more gentle sort of, like, cozy catastrophe, sort of Day of the Triffids type stuff where, you know, there's the end of the world, but people survive, and it's how they survive and thrive, you know, all that kind of stuff. So I was sort of into that. And, you know, ultimately, video games sort of like, I mean, you know, it's perfect video game fodder, right? You know, you're in a hostile environment. So even very early on, like Missile Command came in, and, you know, that was like sort of echoed the sort of Cold War nuclear kind of fear of nuclear destruction sort of thing. And so, you know, that was interesting. But then, you know, as video games went on, you know, you began to see sort of more post-apocalyptic Mad Maxy type things, because, you know, the people that were making those kinds of games were also, like me, you know, influenced by the same books that were around and about at that time, you know, the sort of the Larry Nivens and, you know, the Asimovs and Arthur C. Clarke's of the world. And so it's not like everybody was doing, but you would just get certain games, you know, that would have that sort of dystopian sort of crumbling future background. And that just played such a huge part of my growing up, even in like magazines, like comics like 2000 AD, and even some of the Marvel comics that I read. You know, I remember like a Marvel team up with Deathlok and Spider-Man going into the future, where it was basically, it was like the Terminator years before the Terminator arrived. You know, there's this like this cyborg robot, you know, in this sort of post-apocalyptic environment, and Spider-Man gets sucked into it. And that was like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing. Spider-Man sort of in a post-nuclear environment with a robot. And cyborg thing, you know,
stuff like the Cursed Earth as well, and stuff like that in 2000 AD.
That was, oh my God, that was so good. You know, I remember like my dad used to bring home my 2000 copy of 2000 AD every Thursday, and I'd be like, literally, especially when the Cursed Earth and the other one was the Block Wars, which transitioned into the sort of the Armageddon, well, the, whatever it was called, Apocalypse Wars, right?
And,
against Russia.
Strontium Dog as well, and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah, and
Fog, yeah. And I would say, I'd be like waiting by the door, like, have you got my magazine? And if he hadn't got it, I would like, you know, sort of want to rip his head off. But, yeah, that was like a, you know, that weekly comic was a sort of like such a big event for me, you know, sort of getting that and being able to read it. So, loved all that stuff. So games about that kind of stuff, couldn't get enough of them.
Well, even kind of, you know, expanding on the sci-fi theme, I guess, you know, Space Invaders, you could say, came out of science fiction. It's a very sci-fi kind of plot when you think about it. And you write about how in 1979 you discovered that game. You tell a great story about how you kind of cracked playing Space Invaders, you know, by figuring out that targeting certain rows first, you could control the pace of the game. I mean, when you realised that, did that make you realise you had a bit of a knack for strategy in games?
Yeah, I mean, you know, even when I was playing Pong, you know, I'd sit there with the little controller and, you know, I'd just be returning it relentlessly because I just could do it. And so I realised, oh, I'm not bad at this. But then, yeah, Space Invaders, that was the weird one. The thing is, like, I've got, like, ADHD. So it was a combination of ADHD plus, you know, what was kind of almost a two-hour bus ride where I had nothing to do. This was pre-phone, pre-Walkman, pre-anything. So it was like literally you'd sit on the bus and there's no way you could read because A, the bus was dark and there's no streetlights, and B, it's wending down these little windy freaking lanes. So if you did try and read, you'd be throwing up within 5 minutes. So you just like sit on the bus and be patient and like an old person. And
no Walkman as well.
So. No Walkman, no nothing. So, of course, having just played Space Invaders and having an ADHD brain that was now absolutely locked into this greatest thing I'd ever seen without doubt, you know, I basically had sort of 2 hours of like supercomputer brain crunching time to kind of think about what I'd seen. And I remember I was just sitting there, I was like running and rerunning, like, what do I do? This is a game and it can't be impossible. You must be able to shoot these things before they land and blow you up. And how do you do that? And so I don't know how long it was, half an hour, 45 minutes. Suddenly I could just like, you came up with the idea. And that's the other thing with ADHD is like sometimes you come up with an idea that you know is right. You can't really prove it's right. You just have this hunch. And, you know, it's the same thing that drove a lot of like things that appeared in my mags that were good. You know, so I don't really know if this will work, but I'm sure of it somewhere in my head. And it was the same thing with Space Invaders. It's like, I think I've come up with this strategy. I'm sure it's going to work. And then I just had to sit at home for a week until I could go back into Aberystwyth and try it out. And lo and behold, it was like, yeah, okay, it's not 100% perfect, but, you know, I'm onto the right thing. And then it was just a case of practicing and putting it into practice. And, you know, within a few weeks after that, yeah, I was shooting down waves of Space Invaders because I think the big breakthrough was actually leaving one invader on the right and shooting the rows out because you could kind of move them slowly and sort of pick things off quite quickly. There was a very specific sort of finesse tactic that you needed to add. It wasn't just shooting rows. It was like almost shooting all of the rows bar one left Space Invader and then it would work. And so, yeah, it took a little bit of practice to you know, sort that out. But once you'd done it, that was it. Done, mastered, you know, you keep going.
Well, being like a competitive gamer is something that you write about as well. So, you know, Missile Commander Defender, you talk about, and Defender was incredibly hard. So kind of mastering that, I remember the first time playing that, like, wow, this is fast.
Lasted about 5 seconds.
Yeah. Was this just like a bit of fun or something that you really wanted to, like, you know, become the best at?
I mean, basically, you know, I started with Pong, then went to Space Invaders. It's not like I was super good at Space Invaders, to be honest. I was never like a super champ at that. What that demonstrated to me was just like I was able to sort of figure out tactics and very quickly. So it was like, oh, okay, I've got an aptitude for sort of like adapting quickly. And then Missile Command came in and actually most of the tactics that I developed for that, I borrowed from other people. But I was able to finesse those tactics and very quickly turn it into I can play all day now. And then I went to Asteroids and the same thing happened. It's like, you know, a couple of weeks, few weeks sort of getting up to speed. And suddenly it was like, all right, yep, I'm there again. I'm getting to the point where I can play for an hour. Now I can play for 2 hours. And now I can play forever. And so I was I was confident that I was at least decent. I was certainly knew I was one of the best in my area. And of course, you know, back then there was no real social or anything like that. So you had no idea what the rest of the country was doing.
Mm.
But I could just tell, it's like, you know, my name's on all of the high school tables in the arcade. I must be decent at least. And then I just began to sort of like go through games, like, what's the next game I want to conquer? And so, you know, around about that time, Defender came along. And yeah, like you, I sat down. My first game lasted probably about 3 seconds, and it was just like, what's going on? So yeah, I just went into hyper focus mode, started practicing like crazy. And then yeah, it took a while, probably a month or so, to get decent at it. And then I began to reach that point where it was like, oh, I can play for 2 hours, now three, and now I've clocked it, and sort of like I'm going around the entire loop. I think now I can play it forever. And so, yeah, it was just, yeah, very, very competitive. It was like, I don't know what a combination of just like a personal interest in, I must beat this game, the stupid, horrible ego show off of, and I want everybody else to see just how freaking good I am, was largely what was driving, you know, motivating me, basically. Plus the fact that I just love playing games. It's like, this is my favorite thing. So it's like, it's my favorite thing, and I'm good at it, and I want to be a show off too. So it was all those things, and that's what sort of fueled my, you know, got to get good.
You know, the early part of the book, obviously, you talk more about growing up in Aberystwyth. And for people who don't know, that's on the coast in Wales. I think you mentioned later on in the book, it's about an 8-hour journey to London on the train.
It is.
Yeah, it's quite isolated. I mean, did you see the rise of video game arcades happen there then? So obviously, the seaside's traditionally where, you know, arcades have been located for, you know, since they began in the UK. I mean, what was kind of your local arcade scene like?
That was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Because it was, I was lucky. Basically, you know, Aberystwyth is a little, tiny town. It's remote, but it has a very strong, at least back then when people were still sort of like holidaying in the UK, a lot of people will come from Birmingham because actually, you know, you can get direct trains from Birmingham to Aberystwyth, and it took a few hours. The pain in the ass was having to change at Shrewsbury and then Birmingham and then to get to London. It made the journey very long. But actually, if you were in the Midlands, it wasn't too bad. So people would take the train and sort of stay in them, all the little holiday cottages and hostels and things there. Point being that in the summer, it was very, very busy. And actually, in the winter, it was also pretty busy because there were about 5,000 students at the University of Aberystwyth. So the town, even though it was remote, was that and kind of cut off, it did have quite a buoyant sort of like population, because in the winter there's the students and in the summer there's the tourists. So, of course, the guy that sort of like owned the Royal Pier very quickly realized, oh, right, you know, if I put video games on the pier, I'm going to make a lot of money. And so he invested quite a lot. So we actually had a really, really good arcade on the pier that got a lot of very new cutting edge stuff. So I was just very, very lucky in that sense and was basically absolutely the front line of sort of like the golden age of arcades explosion through 1979 to, you know, 1983-84 when it reached its sort of peak.
I love your stories about kind of almost, you know, you were hustling a bit in the arcades, helping people win on fruit machines.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was the thing. I was, you know, sort of like, yeah, you know, we lived in mid Wales on a little tiny farm and, you know, we didn't have a lot of money. You know, I mean, I used to get free school dinners and stuff because we didn't have that much money and even like school uniform and allowances. So, you know, it's not that, and that wasn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I was very happy at home and I got, you know, comics and stuff like that. So it was, you know, it wasn't like we were destitute, but I didn't have really much money to play games. And so, again, it was like an ADHD thing. It's like, I want to play these games. And so, you know, what am I going to do about this? I didn't want to be thieving stuff because, you know, it just wasn't me. But yeah, I looked at the environment and just, you know, began to figure out, like, where can I source money from? And yeah, that was hanging out by the penny falls machines after somebody had dumped a bunch of money in to it, waiting for that teetering pile of 10 pence pieces to fall so I could go and scoop them up before anybody else did. Or, yeah, like I say in the book, watching, I had this, like, environmental awareness. You know, there's a tourist over there and he's been on that machine for 5 hours. And I know for the fact that, you know, he hasn't really won anything. So that machine's stuffed full of money. So if maybe I put in a few credits, I have a very high chance of getting a jackpot. And so I used to do that all the time. Plus, if somebody got nudges and stuff, I knew all of the reels off by heart. I'd learned them. And you know, I could say, oh, you got a melon sort of just out of sight around there. If you bring it down, you can get the jackpot. And especially tourists would always give me like, you know, 10, 20p. Oh, thanks, mate. You know, oh, can you stand here and maybe help me some more? And yeah, I'd pick up money. So it's not like I was making bank by any stretch. But at the same time, you know, unless I was sort of in the learning mode, which was always the biggest pain in the ass because you'd be shoveling coins in and would require that quite a lot of extra money. Once I'd sort of reached the reasonable point of like, you know, can play for 2 or 3 hours, you know, that was great. I'd only need 20p. And it's like, all right, now I can spend the rest of the day playing Defender. So because, you know, I could play it forever. So that turned out to be really good. Not so good for the arcade because, I mean, like one point I remember playing for the maximum amount of time I could play with the pier being open was 18 hours. And I did 18 hours on 10p. So they had their Defender machine make the princely sum of 10 pence in a day, which I'm sure electricity wise was, you know, put them into to a loss.
Well, I loved your story about your trip to WH Smith as well. So, you know, talking about magazines, that was the home of magazines. But you picked up CVG and you went to fill in the entry for the 1983 Arcade Championship.
That's right.
I was wondering, had you paid much attention to CVG before and like, were you a regular?
Kind of yes and no. I mean, the thing with like games mags back then, I mean, A, they were written by journalists because actually gamers didn't quite exist then. You know, they're sort of like, gamers were still emerging. So to sort of like write a magazine, you had to be, you know, it's like, oh, you have to be a writer. You can't be a gamer. What do they know about writing? They'd review games and he'd be like, what on earth are you talking about? You know, he'd be like spending the entire like review talking about like the name of the game or like why the box art doesn't quite match what's going on in the game. And you're like, what are you doing? You know, it's like, tell me, like, are the graphics good? Is it fun to play? Is it difficult? You know, all of the things that you want a review to tell you. And in those early days, it just sort of like, you had some people that got it, but you also had a bunch of people that didn't. So point being, it's like a combination of that plus the fact that magazines back then were just packed full of crummy type-in listings, which I was just absolutely not interested in whatsoever. So those early CVGs, you know, there might be a couple of reviews in them and like maybe and the arcade action page, which was like a really big thing for me. It's like, you know, oh, what's the next arcade game that I can keep an eye out for? Mm. That was the stuff that I was really interested in. And you know, I could go into Smith's, read that in 5 minutes and put the mag back and save myself a quid.
Yeah.
Which I could then put into Defender. So for quite a few years, probably up until about 1983, I wasn't really buying computer game magazines. I'd borrow friends, you know, I might acquire them, like somebody might have finished one and I'd take it home and because he'd give it me or whatever. But I wasn't actually buying magazines. Like all the money I had was basically going into coin slots at that point. So, you know.
Well, that quid that you did spend on that issue of CVG to fill in the entry form, I mean, that was well worth it because you went to the Arcade Championships. You mentioned that 8-hour train journey over to London as well. I mean, there's some great pictures in the book of you playing at the event and also with Dave Lee Travis, who for our non-UK listeners, he was a kind of a 70s and 80s slightly cheesy radio DJ. Is it his nickname, the Hairy Cornflake, if I remember correctly? Yeah. I mean, what memories have you got of competing in that and winning it?
Yeah, that was really fun. I mean, you know, the thing is, it's like I'm a really big introvert. So even though, like, I go to shows and I talk to people and all that kind of stuff, and people sort of like think I'm fairly normal, but I actually it causes me grief. You know, it's like makes me nervous. I don't. Once I know people, I can talk to them and stuff like that. But just the concept of sort of walking into places with strangers in them just was pretty terrible. So coming up like fresh off the farm and going down to London, yeah, it was like really overwhelming. But at the same time, you know, underneath it was just this sort of like confidence of like, I know I'm good. You know, I'm sure I can do well here if I just, you know, stay calm. And so, you know, I did what I could, you know, sort of got as much information as I could about what was going on, what people were playing, who was good and not, you know, and just, when it was my turn to get up, you know, I got up and had figured out a strategy, which I don't think the others, basically sort of like the competition was, there were six arcade games that people had qualified on. So there were three people per arcade game. And it was like stuff like Robotron and, Defender, which is what I qualified on. And I think that was a Pac-Man maybe or whatever. But the point being, each of the three, players for each of the machines had 10 minutes to notch up the biggest scores. And then the top score on each of the six machines, the top scorers, they went through to the final, and those six players then played the mystery machine, which was Gyrus and a machine that nobody had ever seen before. So knowing that we had 10 minutes to just play Defender, I actually used that sort of sat down and just thought, all right, what's the sort of like the highest score I can get in 10 minutes, which wasn't the same as what the other two did, which was just like, I'm going to play Defender as well as I can for 10 minutes and get a good score. I was like, oh no, you know, what I really need to do is not play fast, but actually score the highest point. So I'm going to make sure that I pick up and drop off the humanoids. I'm going to, you know, sort of like play a bit slower to amass a score rather than just sort of like trundling forward and playing kind of normal. So that strategy put me through to the final quite strongly because I really outscored the other opponents because I had that. And then at that point, it really was just like improvise and figure it out as you go along, because it was like, there you go, here's your machine. You look at it for like probably 5 seconds, you know, whatever part of the attract mode it was on. And the whistle blows and you're playing. And it's literally like, all right, the left, right. Ooh, there's stuff coming out of the middle of the screen. What do I do here? What kind of game is this? Oh, I can actually go around the screen. It's not like a regular shooter where it's you're just at the bottom of the screen. So, you know, there was all of that. And I just, you know, I just happened to be good, very good at playing a game that I've never seen before. Because actually that's what made me really good at reviewing too, was the fact that that aptitude, you know, a game would come in and I could sit down and kind of suss it out very quickly and play through it and then write a review, knowing that I've gone through the entire game and in the morning that I had to review the game, because that's how fast we were getting banging out reviews at that point. It was like, you know, two reviews a day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. And you'd have to finish those games. No way you could do that these days, you know, like the idea of playing like World of Warcraft for a morning and then writing review does, you know. But back then, yeah, you know, you had these easy games. And sometimes, you know, you'd have a super easy game where you'd be like, I finished the whole thing in 20 minutes. And that happened numerous times.
So you first appeared in CVG magazine when you were writing gaming tips. Where did that idea come from? And how did you go about it as well, getting involved?
Well, the thing is, because the Arcade Championships was a CVG sponsored event, I'd kind of, you know, met some of the magazine folks there and sort of had chatted to them. But I think what happened was after the championship, I can't remember if it was before or after, but it was around that time, I played Pole Position for the first time. I played that and I was like, oh, this is really good. And also I got good quick at it again. And I realized that, yeah, I'm miles better than everybody else in the arcade. Maybe. And that coincided with me. I'd also had this How to Master the Video Games tips book from America. I'd had that for about a year and a bit. And I'd sort of been reading that and just, I'm sitting there and just the idea of like, hey, that guy wrote that book about tips and stuff. And Pole Position is new and that's not in the book. Well, maybe I can write about Pole Position and, you know, do something with it. And I thought, well, you know, I'm CVG's champ. Maybe if I just write it and send it to them, say, oh, look, you know, I won your championship. Would you be interested in me writing tips for you? Because they weren't really doing tips back then at all. This was like before people realized just how important tips were. Like, the most important part of a magazine, other than maybe reviews, they're kind of on the same level at that, especially during that era. So I said, oh, I'll do these tips, sent them off to CBG, and they were like, oh yeah, these are great, here's some money. And then like, bing, all right, I can make money doing this. That's
you
what
got a
I
whopping
need to
£100
do.
For your first article I read.
Yeah, that was a vast sum of money back then, especially since I wasn't actually expecting to get any money.
Yeah.
So, you know, sort of like literally sort of coming from sort of scraping together 10 pence pieces from sort of like helping somebody win a jackpot to having 100 quid in my pocket was for what I felt was like super easy work that I'd spent a couple of hours doing. It was like, oh my God, this is absolutely brilliant. I've got to get more of this going on.
Well, obviously, that kind of kickstarted a whole career ever since. And I mean, you're just 18 years old when you landed your dream job at Zap 64, what will be a dream job for many of us. And you described walking into the offices for the first time as well and seeing those stacks of games. I mean, did you kind of feel like you'd made it then? And kind of what was that those first early days like at Zap?
Yeah, it was weird. And in fact, it's funny because February 18th, 1985 was when I walked into the Zap offices for the first time, which I believe is probably like next Monday or something like that, right? It's next Tuesday. So, next Tuesday week will be the precise 40th anniversary of me actually being a games reviewer and joining magazines, which is sort of weird. And again, sort of like part of the reason why the book came out when it did, as it is that anniversary. But yeah, walking into this, you know, it was odd. It was like, okay, I'm sort of walking into this environment. I'd met and interviewed Chris, obviously, and I'd been down to London to talk to him for the job interview. So I kind of knew him. And I also met Gary Penn at an event at Personal Computer Games, which was Chris's previous magazine that he'd been at. And he'd held this sort of gaming contest, and Gary and I had been part of that, and so I kind of knew Gary, so it was like, oh okay, you know, sort of I didn't have that sort of absolute terror of that I'm walking into a room and don't know anybody. So kind of sat down and we began to chat, and it just very difficult to describe, and it's a very sort of surreal feeling of like I know I'm here. And we're beginning to talk about, like, you know, what the magazine should be, because that's, we literally made a cup of tea, and Chris is like, all right, let's get going. What do you think? I've got a rough editorial plan of what I think the mag should be, but I want you guys to, you know, give your feedback. So we started going through it, and it was great, because, you know, the job interview I'd had with Chris, you know, we've kind of established that. And this is why he hired me, you know, it's because I had similar ideas to him about reviews. Mm. Yeah. We need to have people's faces on the reviews. Wouldn't it be great if we had like little thumbs up and thumbs down, so you like icons, so you could see immediately whether the reviewer liked the game or not. You know, there's got to be lots of screenshots. It's got to do this. It's got to do that. So that kind of like, we spent most of the first day just going through what the mag is going to be. So we kind of knew what we were working towards. And by the end of the day, it just felt very comfortable. And that sort of, it still felt very surreal because I just hadn't got used to it. But at the same time, it's like, it was reality. Here I am. Okay. I'm working on a magazine now, and we're going to make it happen. Probably like when we actually got the first printed copies of Zap in, whenever that was, like probably about 2.5 months later, because we had like a lag between, you know, creating the first issue and everything that needed to go into it. A much, much longer production schedule than a normal magazine. But when I saw the magazine and, you know, had our faces in it and our writing and stuff, that was like, all right, yep, yeah, it became real then. It's like, yeah. And I that was kind of one of my favorite things about working on magazines, was the fact that, you know, you'd have this sort of crazy month where you'd be slogging away. By the end of it, this thing would arrive, and it was a physical thing. It's like, that's what I made. That was, you know, the effort was all worth it. And you'd start looking through it and be like, oh, that's really cool. I like that, you know, that sort of thing.
And then it starts all over again.
Yeah. And then, yes, yeah, straight back onto the bus, you know, and so off you go.
Well, one of your first big reviews at Zap was The Sentinel by Jeff Crammond. And That was an amazing game. You said it kind of messed with your head because it was so unique. Do you remember the first time you kind of sat down and really had a big play session with that game?
Actually, I remember the first time it being shown to us. I think that had the biggest impact because, you know, up it came and it was pretty much the full game. And it was shown to us, unlike a lot of games where you like might get to see an early preview of a level or something like that. This sort of, I think probably the nature of the programming, it's like it didn't really work until the very end when sort of all its maths and algorithms sort of actually worked together properly. So up came this 3D environment that's like, ooh, that's really cool. And then, you know, I can't remember if, I don't think Jeff actually bought it to us. I think it was actually just sent to us.
Because it was through Firebird, wasn't it?
So. Yeah. And so I think it was bought to us by the PR person. I can't really remember clearly. But either way, I remember looking at it and then him moving the environment, and it taken a while obviously to render it, but you didn't really think about frame rate back then because, you know, you did but you didn't. Sort of in a game like this, it was like, oh, okay, it just takes that long to calculate this 3D environment, and that's really impressive because it's calculating a 3D environment, a very complex one that looks really, really cool. So, and in fact, that sort of pause was part of the game. It sort of made the game very steady. It added this sort of specific cadence to it that kind of added to the tension and stuff. So it was just an incredible thing looking at it. And then, you know, as we learn more about it, it's like it's got whatever it had, 10,000 mathematically generated levels and all this kind of stuff. It's like, holy crap, this is like clever programming in the same way that Elite was, if you know what I mean. It's like, you know, Elite came along and you looked at it and you were like, it's not just sort of like everyone's a Wally sprites moving about the screen thing, you know, which is like cool, but kind of straightforward. This was like, all right, this is doing something that I've never seen before. Elite was kind of doing something that I'd never seen before. We'd seen Battlezone and vector graphics and stuff like that, but you know, this was like, oh no, this is a 3D environment that you can move in that is got, you know, it there's time and space elements to it, you know, there's distance to it. This is just incredible. And probably in the same way that Mercenary did too. I mean, when you look at that period of sort of like 85, 86, there were some incredible innovations there. You know, the Mercenary coming into the office and it really being the first 3D open world game. And, you know, just sort of like the concept of realizing that, oh, that thing over there is actually a spaceship that you can step into and then take off and fly around. We'd had flight sims before, but this was a whole new level because you're flying along. It's like, oh, there's a bridge down there and I can see it and I can fly under the bridge and there's a sign and there's street grids and there's buildings. And, oh, I can go into the building and take an elevator down to the underground. I mean, that was just out of nowhere. Suddenly being able to do that was just, I remember Gary and I looking at each other at one point when we were playing Mercenary, as we really began to realize sort of like what it was and how big it was. And the fact that you were in this world and you were doing things for people and getting money and buying things. It's like, Jesus Christ, where's this going to go next? Because as the tech gets better, you know, we just knew we could extrapolate out because that was part of, you know, what we were good at is like we had that imagination. And I remember sitting there thinking like, yeah, there's no reason that as memory becomes bigger and graphics become better, that this couldn't be a whole city. I mean, it took decades to get there, but it did eventually.
Into 16K, they could fit that game. So that was incredible programming.
Yeah. And that was the thing, you know, it's like these guys sort of like essentially bringing modern day concepts, game concepts to life, very rudimentarily, but that it was there, you know, it was there. It's, you know, like building the first car, right? I mean, these were the first games of a certain type and watching that and kind of, you know, the fact of being there and being able to play it, that was fantastic. But it also had that additional bonus of where could this go? What more could be done with this? That was also really exciting and largely why we got so excited about things. You know, it was the reality of what was happening, but also the portent of the future of video games that we could also see. that kind of just added to that excitement. It's like, yeah, where's this going to go? It's so cool.
And obviously, I mean, writing for Zap 64, you're covering the Commodore 64. You had your sister magazine, Crash, as well, covering the Spectrum. You know, before that, I mean, you're really writing about home computers at this stage, home micros. And then you talk about in the book in 1986 going to Activision's HQ and seeing the NES for the first time. So what did you think of that then and the idea of consoles?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when you look at the early days, it was consoles. You know, you had the Atari 2600 and the Coleco and things like that. But very quickly in the UK, and those were more American things, in the UK, consoles were expensive, but, you know, things like the ZX80 were cheap. And also kids had access to computers in the classroom. So they had pets and things like BBC micros and stuff. So, you know, so it's a bit, and because of that, and that was true across Europe, you know, home computers were the cheaper thing and those became kind of more prevalent. So, you know, there was this sort of feeling back then that it was always going to be computers. But then suddenly, you know, I remember seeing this Nintendo and it being explained that it was this, you know, it's Japanese, but this is the American version. And we just had it sent over so we could look at some of the games on it. And seeing Mario for the first time, you know, just the quality of it, you know, the smooth scrolling, the feel of the gameplay, the great music, just, you know, it's the beautiful tuning of the mechanics and gameplay. All of that was just like, holy crap, this is real, what we would call arcade quality, right? You know, it's just like, it feels like an arcade game. It's super smooth. It's really lovely to play. And, you know, as I began to play it, and holy crap, it's got secrets in it. I just found this whole underground bit with this thing, and then I pulled down on a pipe, and now I'm here. And, you know, just that mind-blowing kind of combo of, like, quality, brilliance. You know, it's one of the great games, right? So you're seeing that, yeah, for the first time. And unless you're some kind of absolute minger, you're going to look at that and go, like, this is incredible. So in terms of sort of like seeing that and then kind of realizing like, hang on a sec, you know, these consoles that were sort of a bit out of date, actually, this one's a bit cheaper. And the idea of it's a box that just does games sort of like really made sense to me. It's because it's like, oh, that's all it does. It doesn't have to have a keyboard or, you know, it's not doing anything other than playing games. So that to me just was a, they already existed, but it was like more the realization of like, yeah, I kind of get this feeling that a box designed to play games is probably going to be better than a computer that is a computer that also plays games.
Yeah.
And so there was just that's when we begin, at least for me, begin to get that shift from, maybe computers aren't exactly the future. They'll definitely always be there and, you know, they are useful and I can see that they're these multi-purpose things. But that's the thing. It's like, in a way, the console felt like a sports car and the computer felt like an SUV. Yeah. It's like, all right, yeah, you know, this computer does everything and you can put your stuff in it and everything like that and it's great. But actually, I just want to drive around like 100 miles an hour like an idiot and the console is the thing for me. So that was my personal kind of shift in tastes from, you know, from computers to consoles. And at the point where it's like, I want to write about these and tell everybody about them because I think they are the future of gaming, which was kind of true.
You definitely did, because I mean, you helped launch Mean Machines after you were at CVG for a while after Zap, and then launched Mean Machines, which was a magazine aimed squarely at console gamers. Very different vibe to those other two magazines. And I'm actually looking here at a scan of the July 1992 issue, and you talk about this in the book Street Fighter 2, and your review of Street Fighter 2 and the Super Nintendo is like just legendary. I'm looking at it now, you know, breakdown of all the characters, so much in here, it looks incredible. And you write about how, you know, the moment you played it, you knew that game was really special. I mean, what do you remember about those early sessions playing Street Fighter 2 and the hype around it as well? Because it was really hyped that summer, wasn't it?
Yeah, and largely by us, you know, which is kind of funny. But yeah, you know, I saw it at the ATEI show in London and, you know, I was sort of like mooching about the show, walked past the Capcom booth, you know, saw this long row of machines that, yeah, instantly saw it was a fighting game and very quickly realized, oh, Street Fighter 2, oh, it's that that fighting game that I played that had the big rubber buttons on it that you'd have to hit really hard to punch, because that was the only version I'd played, and it wasn't very good. And in fact, Street Fighter is, you know, it, you can see where it was going, but at that point it wasn't quite there yet. And Street Fighter 2 got it all right. The controls were perfect. Everything about it was absolutely spot on. And so, you know, I started playing the game at the show, you know, sight unseen, never even heard of it. It was just like, there it was. And I started playing, you know, loved Karate Champ, in your Yi El Kung Fu and those kinds of games. And first of all, you know, it looked unbelievably good. You know, the characters were incredible. The quality of the animation was, you know, fantastic. The sound was brilliant. But the controls were, you know, I mean, you played it, legendary. Absolutely. As a sort of like a, you know, considering how complicated the game was, it felt intuitive. And the thing I think, you know, immediately struck me is like, okay, these characters are doing what I want to do when I want to do it, exactly when I want to do it. It's not like kind of Karate Champ where you're moving joysticks to sort of like do combo moves and it's all a bit clunky. And even Yi El Kung Fu was clunky. It's like, I can do a roll forward, do a jump, kick in midair, land in a crouch, and then do a low crouching punch. It's like, and it's all one move. And so kind of this, all these realizations were going on, like, wow, this is a fighting game where you got individual characters and they all do different things. They all have different skills. You've got controls that really allow you to actually express yourself, because you can do your own combos and moves to kind of baffle the player. If the player keeps running towards you, you can feint and block and then jink forward and punch. And, you know, it was like, this is like very fast, real time, proper combat where I really feel like a combatant, where I can really use my kind of individual skill and style to defeat somebody else. Yeah. And while that latter part took longer to realize, most of it was, I was beginning to realize almost straight away, because as I was playing, somebody else kind of muscled in and pressed the two-player button and started fighting me. And at that point, most two-player fighting games were a bit kind of clunky and crap and not very good. But again, you know, it became apparent that this was built as a two-player game. You didn't really, you know, you could play against the computer characters, but actually the really fun bit was fighting against somebody else, because, you know, you would have to adapt and improvise to their own strategies, and you'd have to outthink them and outwit them, and that was infinitely more fun than fighting against a computer. Plus, it was still a time, even though it was weird to think, like in the 90s, where, you know, that sort of like side-by-side gaming kind of did exist, but it had never really happened in a way that was that brilliant. Yeah. You know, like Street Fighter 2 took that side-by-side gaming to a whole new level, which is why, you know, you had this scene suddenly emerge. I remember seeing it in like my local arcades were all in Southend. I literally lived up the road from the seafront. And I'd go down there and you'd see these groups of people, you know, in the arcades. There were regulars in certain arcades because that's where they hung out. They'd, you know, they had mates. They would fight each other, you know, and it was sort of ongoing. And I'd never really seen that before. Sure, I'd seen sort of groups of people hanging out together, but the whole idea of like people going just to play Street Fighter and they're, you know, them having competitions and even betting on people, that used to happen a lot in certainly in London and definitely in Southend. You know, I'd turn up and people would know me and we'd be awkward on him, you know, and yeah. You know.
Well, seeing that on TV as well was an amazing thing as well. You know, Games Master and Games World, they had like competitive gameplay on there. What was it kind of like making that transition, you know, from print to TV?
It was odd. I mean, you know, I think at the time, you know, I mean, obviously I was seen as an authority on games because I'd been on, you know, made so many magazines and, you know, my faces were sort of on different things. And so, you know, they called me up and asked me to come over and, you know, to be honest, it was always a bit of a pain in the ass because I had a full-time job and actually it could be quite time consuming because the way Games Master was done, and you can actually tell when you watch those shows because you know, you have people wearing the same clothes for like 4 weeks straight, the reviewers, you know, you go in there and you would like spend all day shooting the reviews, and they would do them all in one go and then like eke them out over like 4 to 6 weeks. And then you'd all go back in again and do the next 4 to 6 weeks worth. So they wouldn't need a production crew every week. And so, that's the way it works. So that whole like having to go over the studio and just like hang about, you know, somebody would be doing their reviews and then the next person, you'd get called up. But then you might have to wait 45 minutes or an hour before you did your next one. And you'd just be sort of like sitting there and it, you know, there's like nothing really to do. And I'd be like, you know, I'm supposed to be making my magazine. I've got this thing I'm supposed to be reviewing.
Or deadlines,
I
need to go.
Yeah, you know, it's like, oh, Christ. So actually, you know, it was kind of fun to do. And, you know, like, you know, Dominic and all the crew. But it was also just really inconvenient. So I you know, did it more for the exposure and to get the magazine in front of people.
Yeah.
Which was fantastic. But actually, you know, in terms of like, did you enjoy doing it? It's like, you know, yeah, kind of, but it was a real pain in the ass.
Well, I mean, if people want to hear more about your times on Games Master, I think we covered a bit more of that in the first episode we did with you. And also you moved to the US as well to work in game development when you went to Virgin Interactive. Obviously, there's a lot more about that in the book as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, for the last few minutes, I'm just conscious of your time, Jazz. I mean, let's get into the book itself, because like we said at the start, the book's titled The Games of a Lifetime. And it's not just a book about games, it is a book about your life told through games as well. I mean, obviously that must have been quite difficult to do in this way rather than like a traditional autobiography. Were there any games that you struggled with including, or games that maybe you left out? How did that kind of balance work?
There were definitely games that I left out. I mean, it had to be. I mean, I've reviewed, it's got to be thousands of games over the years. It's got to be. And so, yeah, there's, you know, there's stuff missing. There's people missing, you know. It was very difficult. Once I sort of like got the concept of, all right, let's sort of like run this as a life story, games sort of witnessed through someone's passage through 60 years of life, basically, or 50 years rather. It was very difficult to kind of really find that right balance. Like, how much do I talk about my mental health? How much do I talk about, you know, my ex-wife, you know, my long-term girlfriend, you know, all of those kinds of things. So I try to keep it a little bit light, talk a bit enough about, so you'd get the context of, all right, yeah, during this period, yeah, it was obviously very high stress and, you know, wasn't a happy person. And that was just to give you more of a context of what I might have been looking at and why I might have thought the things that I did at the time. So it was sort of like important to me to do that context. But obviously, because, I mean, it is a big book anyway at 420 pages, you know, I didn't want to overwrite it. And that was always the danger. It's like I wanted the focus to be on the games with the life anecdotes, kind of breaking things up and mostly trying to sort of either humanize certain things, which is important to me, or funny anecdotes, or that's pretty cool that he managed to somehow get into a, you know, the after party with REM and, you know, Radiohead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still early in the morning. And those kinds of things where you sort of go, all right, well, you know, his life was at least interesting. But it the focus is on the games, and that's what I'm trying to do here, really. It's just sort of like the fact that games have been my life, and I make no bones about that. You know, I just love them. I always have done. And so, you know, this is a sort of a celebration of, like, this is what I did in my life. But while I was doing it, this is all the really cool stuff I was playing and enjoying and you know, and some stuff that I looked at and perhaps didn't enjoy that other people did, and I explain why.
Well, Jazz, the book is just an incredible journey, and it really is a journey, you know, through like five decades from like the dawn of the industry, like you said, through all those incredible stories, incredible games as well. It is available now. The book landed on Monday, 10th of February. So if you want to get hold of it, bitmapbooks.com, or you can head to jazzbook.com, a direct link as well. I'll put the links in the show notes as well, so people can click through. And hopefully some of the stories we've heard over the last hour will have whetted people's appetites, and I encourage everyone to go and check the book out, and best of luck with it.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed chatting to you, and I appreciate you having me on.